This is Rod Ross. Today, Monday, the 25th of April, 1983, I shall be speaking with Judy Pond, P-O-N-D, Director of the Speakers Bureau, here in room 415 of the old Executive Office Building in Washington, D.C. Judy, why don't we start by having you tell a little bit about yourself. Where are you from? What educational background? How did you happen to get involved in Republican politics?
Oh, okay. I was born in Whitefish, Montana. I graduated from college in 1968 from the College of William & Mary, and began a career in lobbying. I was 13 years in Washington as a lobbyist.
With whom?
First with the National Food Processors Association, then with the Ralston Trading Company. And through John Sears, I was asked to work on the campaign while I was still at Ralston on my own time. And I was...
This is the 1980 campaign?
Yes. And I was vice chairman of the D.C. Finance Committee. That was before the convention.
What were your responsibilities as vice chairman of the D.C. Finance Committee?
Well, I was working with the chairman to try to...
Who was the chairman?
The chairman was Clarence McKee. We were basically doing some fundraising among interest groups in Washington, and my area was the corporate representatives in Washington, the other lobbyists. So we planned a couple of fundraising events and tried to involve the corporate Washington community and campaign.
For the fundraising events, were there any particular speakers that you had or any particular locations? Were these Georgetown residences? Or?
That's what we had planned. I don't think actually any of them happened. We planned them, but I don't think anything took place that I'm aware of. Then in March of 81, I was asked to come over and run the Speakers Bureau, well, start the Speakers Bureau.
How did you happen when you said you were asked? Was this, you know, Dave Gergen called you on the phone, or?
No. The person then who was director of, I'm trying to remember what we were calling it then, it's the office that now is a dual office, which is public affairs and media liaison.
So this is Frank Orsamoroso.
And it was Frank Orsamoroso, but I don't remember what we called the office then when it was all under him. But anyway, he called me and asked me to come in to interview, which I did.
Had you had contact with him previously?
No. The person who, in a sense, brought me into the White House was Paul Russo. In the political office, and I assume the contact was made from him to Orson Marso.
So you were called in for the interview, and what, 2 weeks later, or
I think
a
it was
later,
less than that. It was about four days later, I think. I came over.
What was the office like when you came over? Or was it just, you know,
bedlam?
Frank Orson Marso and the secretary?
Yes. No, I think there was actually, there were two people that came in either the day before I did or the same day I did. So there may have been a total of four of us plus Frank when I first started. And there was a secretary who was office manager, and Jan Mahan, who is still here doing media consulting. And Ann Graham, who's gone on to education. I think we were the first four.
What were your responsibilities?
Well, Frank handed me a whole set of files, which were requests for speakers. And my task was to establish some kind of a Speakers Bureau. I called it the Speakers Bureau. They were still calling it the Surrogates Program, because that's what had been called in the campaign.
Are you talking about cabinet secretaries,
mm-hmm,
or White House staff? Or
everyone. everyone. In the campaign, of course, surrogates. There were all kinds of people who were considered surrogates who were in the private sector and associated with the campaign and that sort of thing. After the inauguration, then it became primarily White House staff, cabinet, and sub-cabinet.
Who were the main speakers? Were there, are there well, a dozen there persons that you could rattle off their names?
It was difficult because in March of 81, I guess most of the cabinet had been confirmed by then, but that was about it. Most of the other nominations were still going through the confirmation process, and one of the policy decisions we made then was that we would try not to send anyone out speaking until they'd been confirmed. So we had very few speakers, and the cabinet members were very, very busy at that time setting up their departments, and really didn't have a lot of time to go out speaking. So in the first, I'd have to look at my records to recall who some of the first speakers were, but I remember placing speakers within a matter of days after I came over here. They were lower level people. I think the very first person I placed was a special assistant to the Secretary of the Department of Labor.
Of the people that, you know, the Speaker's Bureau gets requests for the President to speak, or can you trace through, you know, an invitation comes into the White House, what's the process between the mailroom opening the invitation and you're deciding that you're going to try finding a surrogate speaker?
Requests come in from several different directions. One, and this is probably the most frequent way we get requests, is declines from the Office of Presidential Appointments. Those are speaking requests that the President has declined, and either because it's been staffed and there's been a recommendation when it was staffed out that a surrogate should be assigned, or it's just the judgment of the people in presidential scheduling that it's an event that warrants some kind of representation, or in the letter itself, the person requesting the President may say, if the President can't come, could we have the Vice President or some other representative? Then those automatically come to me for a response. They come to me right from the public, the direct public. Directly, the public will sometimes. There's been a Speaker's Bureau, first of all, in the White House, back as far as I know, as far as the Eisenhower administration. I don't know how far back it goes beyond that. So there's some knowledge out there in the public that such a thing exists, and so there are some people who regularly make inquiries to the Speaker's Bureau at the White House, just out of the blue, for a speaker. They also would come into me from the Office of Public Liaison for their constituent groups, through the Office of Political Affairs, and through Government Affairs, or what do we call it, Legislative Affairs. That's it.
Of persons that you arrange for, you know, speaking on behalf of the administration, do they get a per diem expenditure, or does the group pay their transportation, or how financially do things work?
As you know, we're not allowed to, administration representatives are not allowed to accept honoraria. They're also not allowed to accept travel expenses, except in the case of an organization which is a non-profit 501c3 organization, which usually rules out all trade associations, groups like educational groups, colleges, that they usually qualify as a 501c3. And we can accept reimbursement for travel expenses and lodging from those groups. But otherwise, it generally comes out of appropriated funds.
Have you been working as well? And do these people go all over the country then?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you have, you know, liaisons, say, with different agencies to try to find out who's available in Commerce that's going to be able to speak in Oregon, you know, in August?
Well, that was one of the biggest tasks to set up the Speakers Bureau, was that early on it was pretty apparent that since the Speakers Bureau was made up of only a staff of two people, we were not going to be able to operate the way, say, a Speakers Bureau back in the Carter administration had, which had 17 people. And I knew I was going to have to rely heavily on the department, so that a request that was clearly a request, which a speaker from HHS said, would be appropriate for, I could refer directly to HHS. One of the things we knew we needed was coordination with those departments, but also a way to know instantly where everyone in the administration is traveling on any given day. So I set up a computer-based system for tracking all the speaking travel. Well, not just travel, speaking, which involved sometimes being in Washington, but also sometimes traveling, so that I would know where all of the spokesmen were, and that would include cabinet, sub-cabinet down to deputy assistant secretary in all of the departments. And that is a calendar that's being produced now on a weekly basis, and it tracks about 700 speaking events a month. So that was one way that I know where people are speaking, so that in case I want to double up on somebody's schedule who's already out somewhere, I can do that. The other thing to coordinate this was to develop a contact in each of the departments, which there is. Some of the departments have had speakers bureaus of some type for a long, long time, like the Department of State. Excuse me, they have about 20 people over there, and they're career people, they're very good. And they call it their Office of Public Programs. But they have a person who's responsible for every region in the country. And they were one of the first groups I contacted when I was trying to find my way through the bureaucracy, because they were well established. You know, in the other departments, that people were coming in just like I was. And there was nothing, no counterpart in other departments. But departments like State and Defense both had very well organized, well established speakers bureaus.
Did you find a speaker for every request that you got, or do you?
No.
Okay. What's the process for reading out requests?
My basic criteria for determining whether or not a request should be filled was the answer to the question, will this help Ronald Reagan by providing a speaker to this group? And helping could take many forms. Helping could mean, is this a good platform for the president's policies to be stated? Will it get us lots of coverage for those policy statements? Is it important to us from a political standpoint? Is it necessary, for instance, to do this because it's important to a constituent group that we're interested in maintaining? And that could be a member of Congress that we would like to be helpful to. Someone in the campaign, a party member who is useful to us. But largely, because this is a part of the communications office and an outreach function of the communications office, my main criteria was that it be a good platform where we could get the most exposure for the president's policies, programs. And so we fill, I think, about 2/3 of the requests that we get.
Go ahead.
1/3 of them are clearly requests that there's just not appropriate. You know, the 8th grade class will invite the president or a representative to come and talk to them about science, and those are not appropriate. But in cases where requests would come to me where I didn't have enough information to determine whether or not it was an appropriate platform for an administration speaker, There are numerous offices in the White House that I would send a staffing memorandum to on the group. So that if it involved international or foreign policy, of course, I'd send it to the NSC. But involved veterans groups or any of those groups that the Office of Public Liaison has in its portfolio, business groups, women's groups, Hispanics, all those groups, I would send and ask for guidance from them on whether or not this is an important group and if this is the best time to do it and all those things.
I've heard for the president's schedule, at least when Bill Sadler was in charge of scheduling, that there'd be group meetings. You were largely a one-person operation, though, or did you and Dave Gergen, make mutual decisions, or was this really your decision?
No, it was always my decision. Occasionally, I would have a request referred to me from some office in the White House with a recommendation to me that it was important that we try to find a speaker. But absent that, it was my decision.
Did you have other responsibilities in the office, or was the Speaker's Bureau largely your operation and you weren't involved with other things that David Gergen would be involved with?
Basically, that was the situation. In the early days, when there were very few of us in the Urso Moiso shop, and Frank's duties included doing briefings for out-of-town editors, I got pressed into service for that, to supply the speakers for one thing, but also to help with the details of those briefings. And that's another operation of the Speakers Bureau now, too, is providing briefings for administration spokesmen. We've had about three or four, I think. The last three we held in conjunction with in cooperation with the Cabinet Affairs Office. We brought in about 200 of our speakers for briefings on whatever happened.
Did you handle this as well?
Mm-hmm.
What can I do? No. How do you decide which out-of-town editors you're going to invite? No.
I didn't have anything to do with that part of it. That's all. Now that's kind of small shop, and she does that.
Where are the briefings? In
450.
450 of the old executive office building. And did you, set up the program then?
Yes. No, not for the out-of-town editors, for the spokesman.
Oh, okay. For the spokesman, what kind of a program? Would it be just one person lecturing the group, or a team series?
No, it was usually a team. Generally, I'm trying to remember which ones we had. The first one was on the budget, and that was, I guess, during the 82 budget push. And, I can't remember back far enough to remember who we had on that one. I better go to a different one. Most recently for the 83 budget, we had, I should go back on that very first one. We had the president there. And Rich Williamson, I think those may have been the only two speakers. I'm not absolutely sure, but anyway, we had intentionally wanted the president for the lead-off briefing as a way to emphasize to the spokesmen how important they are and how much we needed them to respond to us when we requested them to accept a speaking engagement. In the most recent one, we had Dave Stockman, Tim McNamara, who I think was filling in for Don Regan. And we had a fellow from the Department of Defense, and Craig Fuller, and Dave Gergen. It would vary with the topic.
Okay. Where are you going now?
The Department of Justice.
What are you going to be doing there?
I'll be Deputy Director of Public Affairs.
How did that transition of jobs came about? Was it something you wanted, or was it something that someone asked you?
I guess it was both. I was looking to do something different in the administration and mentioned it to a friend of mine who happened to be at the Federal Trade Commission, and she put me on to a woman who was doing the recruiting, the preliminary screening for candidates for this deputy director position at Justice. So we set up a meeting, and she interviewed me and then set up interviews at the Department of Justice. And then it was kind of a period of negotiating between myself and the person who's currently there as director. And for some reason, it took a long time. I think the reason mostly was that the person who was having to make this decision was doing some traveling with the Attorney General, so it was taking a little bit of time. But it finally culminated in, I interviewed with the Attorney General probably almost a month ago now, and he asked me to come over there. A couple of days later, I notified the person who had been recruiting me that I'd agreed to do that.
Very good. What's going to happen with the Speaker's Bureau? If they're going to keep the same
I don't know. You know, John Harrington was looking at that operation as a part of this overall evaluation. I had some recommendations for what could be done differently with it if they intend to keep it as it is, but I don't know what he recommended.
Okay. Is there any one particular Speaker's Bureau accomplishment that gave you just immense satisfaction that it worked out right?
Oh gosh, I can think of one speaking request that was kind of amusing, but also ended up working out very well. I'm not sure to call it an accomplishment. I suppose in terms of accomplishments, I think just getting the thing started, you know, walking in the first day and there wasn't one piece of paper to start from. The Speaker's Bureau didn't exist. And to go from that point to setting up a system that runs very well now and is coordinated with the departments, and we send out all kinds of materials to speakers to keep them briefed, and the briefings. I suppose that first briefing was, I felt a great deal of accomplishment from that, because I'd been wanting to do it for a long time and it was badly needed. The speakers needed to be brought in and made to feel that they were part of the team. And it was difficult to get that on the president's schedule. And that was a very big accomplishment, because it was something I would reap from in the future. But if you want anecdotes, I have lots of those.
Yeah, why don't you take just one anecdote?
All right. And this is kind of a typical sort of thing that will happen with the Speaker's Bureau. The Speaker's Bureau ended up being, in way too many cases, in my opinion, sort of the office of last resort. It's when all well-laid plans had gone awry and the speaker had fallen through, or they hadn't been able to get one, and they finally come to the Speaker's Bureau. So it wasn't unusual that we would get very last-minute speaking requests, and this one came in to me from, came in from Paul Russo from the political office. And it was a congressman up in New Hampshire, Judd Gregg, who had on his program a very well-known older woman as a commencement speaker for the graduation ceremonies at the University of New Hampshire. She was down here serving on the President's Committee on Aging and got ill and wasn't going to make it back for the commencement, which was coming up in about 2 weeks. And I began working feverishly with his office people, and there was no one in the administration that was going to be near there or available or appropriate or anything else that I could determine. And we had just formed the President's Task Force on Private Initiatives. So I start, and that's one of the things I look for whenever I have an out-of-the-way speaking request. We have all sorts of private citizen task force groups and advisory councils that I draw on for speakers, because the people on them are usually well known famous even, and so they make good speakers, if, as long as they agree philosophically with us. In this case, it was a situation where I really, it didn't, the philosophical point wasn't as important, it's a commencement, so that wasn't necessary. But I noticed that on the President's Private Sector Initiative Task Force was Bob Wyman. That's right. It's Bob Wyman, who's president of CBS. He was up in New York, and that was the closest person I could find that seemed right for this. And the task force had just been announced that day, so I called the staff people over there and asked them if they could locate a speaker up there and mention that he would be good. Well, long story short, they went through several people that could have done it in that area, and it turned out they got Bob out of a meeting to tell him that we wanted him to do this, and he got back to me to tell me that he would be delighted to do it because, in fact, he was planning to go up there already because his own son was in that graduating class, and he only asked that we try to maintain a secret about the whole thing. He wanted to surprise his son that he was the speaker. So it worked out just beautifully. And the school was delighted, and we were delighted, and he was delighted, and that doesn't happen very often.
That sounds just spectacular. Is there another anecdote of equal? It's hard to top that one.
That was probably the happiest outcome that I can think of. There's all sorts of horror stories, which I won't tell you when it doesn't work. But I think I'll leave it with that one.
Okay. You had worked in Washington, though, as a lobbyist. What kind of different perspective did you get having worked from within the White House than what you might have anticipated and didn't turn out that way at all?
Mm. Well, the first thing that I noticed was having come out of a corporate environment where everything is really very structured and reporting lines are very rigid, and it's just very structured. I was struck by how unstructured the White House seemed to me to be. That the people with different reporting lines to let's say the people reporting up through the Meese line and people reporting up through the Baker line, that those lines weren't always observed very carefully, and that people were always crossing those lines and working all over the place with different offices, and there is not a corporate structure as such in the White House. And as a corollary to that, I noticed how I was surprised by how political everything in the White House is. Political not in the sense of campaign politics, political in the sense of what really makes things work is personalities working on each other rather than a structure at work. And so to get things done, I mean, it's always important in any organization to have interpersonal relationships to get things done. But in the White House, those seem to be more important than anything else to finally getting something done. And that it surprised me the degree that operates. It seems to operate very well, and I suspect it's a holdover from the campaign, because so many people that are here, particularly in those first few weeks, were right off of the campaign. And they think quite a bit differently than the people do in the other kind of organization, I think. It's everything happens so fast. It's a different mindset.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add for the tape?
No, except that this has been the most exciting 2 years of my life. I've worked harder and learned more and done more in 2 years than I had done in 13 years before this. I I leave reluctantly, but I needed a new challenge.
Okay, very good. Thank you.